Okay, thank you. Good morning. This is a session with two papers. We don't have a moderator, but we kind of decided we'll split it 37 minutes each. So I'll read my paper and we'll take a few questions, and at 10:22, I'll turn it over to Laura. Okay, there's a handout going around. You haven't got a copy. Is this still going around? Has anybody got a copy? A bit short of. Okay, I think I have a couple more. Who needs a copy? Can we be temperate and share?
Do I have to go to Pakistan and have some for me? Try to have some for me.
Yeah, I thought I had about 20 copies. I didn't know how many there are. It's all right if you just share. And, okay, I kind of get a sense from looking at the program that temperance is being interpreted very broadly in this conference, but I'm going to take a very narrow view. I'm just basically looking at temperance as a virtue, as Aristotle would discuss it, right? Basically, the idea of why it's wrong to have too much of a thing, okay, or to give your desires full rein to basically, the problem I'm discussing is what's the difference between temperance and self-control. Okay, because there's an interpretation of Aristotle's Ethics by John McDowell. Okay, this is not a new interpretation. He actually published this view in 1979. It's printed on your handout. Right? He distinguishes the virtue of temperance from self-control or continence as follows. The temperate person supposedly sees no reason to do the intemperate act, whereas the self-controlled person is tempted but succeeds in overcoming the desire to act intemperately. What does this mean? Is the temperate person not motivated to get more of something desirable? Take, for instance, someone who does not eat or drink intemperately. Such a person is motivated to eat or drink, but not to excess. What stops her from eating or drinking when she has the right amount? If she has to do something to stop herself, it looks like self-control, right? There's supposed to be a difference. What's the difference? If she does not have to stop herself, has she suddenly lost motivation to eat or drink? But a temperate person surely is not someone who has simply lost her appetite. Since temperance, like other states of character, is about what a person is motivated to do or not do, perhaps the difference between temperance and self-control can be fleshed out in terms of the possession or absence of certain desires. The thing about virtues in this way provides a handle on the question I'm examining. On McDowell's account, the temperate agent looks like someone who lacks any desire to get more of something than what is right for her. This is not the same as lacking any desire whatsoever for the thing. It's just that one desires the thing, but not too much of it. The self-control agent, on the other hand, does not just desire the thing, but desires it beyond what is right for her. That's why she needs self-control. The question to ask is how one could desire to have a thing X, but not desire to have too much of the very thing. The self-control person is motivated by the desire to have X, to get as much of X as she can, and she has to struggle with herself to prevent this desire from being effective after she had enough of X. The absence of such a struggle is supposed to be the mark of temperance. But why is the desire to have X not motivating the temperate person to have more of X without the struggle that typifies the self-control agent? So basically, the self-control agent and the temperate person does the same thing, right? They don't take more of X. But the difference is the self-control person has a struggle. The temperate person has no struggle, right? So let me first say something about desire. There's a conceptual connection between desire and motivation. Someone who is not in the least motivated to act in pursuit of Y cannot be said to desire why. The view that desire is essentially motivational has been contested. Right? Some critics of the view use examples of inert desires. But I think the motivational thesis can be defended against counterexamples if we take a broad enough view of motivation, one that includes the potential to motivate in the right circumstances. Okay, so sometimes they say, well, why is there an essential link if some people who desire something never do anything about it? Well, because the circumstances are never right. Okay, so they still have the potential to motivate. And in cases where physical action is impossible, there is at least the motivation of mental activity such as practical reasoning and fantasizing. Even an example of desiring things that one can do next to nothing about, such as a desire for world peace or for the Cubs to win the World Series, can fit the motivational thesis if you count the motivation of feelings of pleasure or displeasure, depending on whether the desired state of affairs eventuates or not. So I think the essential connection can be defended. So if the temporary agent is not motivated to act in pursuit of X at the point where she has the right amount, it seems that one of two things must apply. Either she did not really desire to have X at all, or something happens that prevents the desire to have X from effectively motivating her. But the agent did have the desire to X, since she was motivated to have X up to that point. So the first alternative doesn't seem to hold. And by hypothesis, the agent does not exercise self-control on the desire to have X. So the question is still, what happens to the temperate agent's desire, which was motivating fine just prior to her reaching the right amount of X? Now, on Aristotle's account, the virtuous person is someone whose reasoning exhibits practical wisdom. So temperance is not just about which desires one has, but doing the right thing because of how one deliberates from the desires that one has. In deliberation, one chooses what to do. A human agent is a person of a will. That is, the faculty that combines reason with desire. One reason that humans need to deliberate is that they cannot satisfy all their desires all the time. In a given situation, a human agent will choose to act on one desire rather than another. For instance, if one were insulted, one may choose to strike back from a desire for revenge, or to ignore the insult from a desire to be forgiving. So I consider three models of choice that can be used to shed light on how a temperate agent's desire is rendered ineffective without the need for self-control. Okay, so we are looking for temperance, right? So a way to make your desire ineffective without actually engaging in self-control. The first possibility involves what I call the circumvention of the desire, where doing one thing just rules out doing the other. Very often we have desires that cannot all be satisfied because the objects of these desires are inconsistent with each other. An example of a contingent conflict between desires is my inability to satisfy both the desire to watch basketball or TV, March Madness, and the desire to keep a promise to attend a colleague's talk. And so in an ideal world, I could do both. An example of an essential conflict between desires is a person's inability to satisfy a desire to be in a monogamous relationship with one's spouse and the desire to have sex with someone who is not one's spouse. Okay, that's an essential conflict. There's no possible world where you can satisfy both desires. Now, it doesn't matter which kind of conflict, whether it's essential or contingent. Even the existence of conflicting desires of either kind, to act on one desire is to rule out acting on the other. But this does not seem to be the right model for temperance, since it would mean that, absent the conflict, there would be no constraint on the desire. If someone wants to have more of two things, but he just doesn't have the money to satisfy both desires, then his failure to satisfy one of the desires is not an example of temperance. He's limited by the world in satisfying the desire, but he's not self-limiting in the way a temperate agent would be. So let's consider a second model of choice. With desires that are not inconsistent, we may decide not to satisfy one desire because we rank another desire higher in terms of its contribution to an ultimate thing of value, such as utility, pleasure, or happiness. It's the task of practical reason to evaluate and choose between desires to maximize overall value. The person may desire to have more of X, but reason shows her that taking into account the cost of having more of X and comparing with other means of getting the ultimate thing of value, she is better off doing something else instead of X. The desire for X is constrained because desires for other things serve his overall interest better. Now, this model of constraint maximization has been presented as an account of moral action by those who suggest that cooperation and other regarding virtues are more favorable to an agent's interest. Okay, this is famously the work of David Gautier in his theory of ethical contractarianism, found in his writings, such as Morals by Agreement. So the idea is that morality is just constraint maximization. You figure out that it's best to cooperate with other people. For instance, a person may desire to forcibly take the property of another person, but her reasoning shows her that doing so will preclude cooperation with others in society, where such cooperation will get more of the things of value and contribute more to her well-being. Now, it seems to me that the person who is constrained by the logic of who is restrained by the logic of constraint maximization is not exemplifying temperance. For with respect to her desire for the thing of ultimate value, she's actually completely unrestrained. And with respect to her desire for the things that are means to this ultimate good, there's no particular point where enough is enough. It depends on what other things are available as means to this good. For instance, if nothing else is as effective as X in securing the ultimate value, then there's no limit to how much of X she should have. And if other means are preferable, then she should not have X at all, unless she's exhausted all these other things. Finally, even if there's a non-zero level, because what I've shown is that it might be all or nothing, but even if there's a non-zero level of X that's reasonable to have under the model of constraint maximization, is there any reason to expect this to be the temperate amount to have? That is, when one reaches the point at which it is better to satisfy other desires instead of X, is that the point where one has the right amount of X, or too much or too little? So there might not be a match between this point of constraint maximization and what we call temperance. Now, there's a third model of choice that I will now propose as an alternative to the model of constraint maximization. The agent could decide not to have more of X, not when she's deciding what to do, but when she's deciding who she is. An account of how the self is constituted through rational choices of the agent is found in the so-called hierarchical model that's associated with Harry Frankfurt. One in which agency and autonomy depends on having second-order desires concerning which first-order desires to endorse. So I'm following Frankfurt's work in Freedom of the Will and the Concept of a Person, and also his paper Identification and Wholeheartedness. A reflective agent, as opposed to a wanton, is one who identifies with some of her first-order desires and disowns others, and she has second-order volitions regarding which desires should be effective in motivating her to act. This self-identification of the agent constitutes her will, and her ability to have the will she wants constitutes her freedom as an agent. So Frankfurt has this view that if you just simply are motivated by first-order desires, you're not really an agent. You need this second-order endorsement to pick and choose which desires you want to motivate you. But I think Frankfurt's account describes self-control rather than temperance. His own example is of the unwilling addict, someone who forms a second-order volition not to act on his first-order desire to take a drug. His second-order volition does not guarantee success. The failure to rein in his first-order desire provides an example of weakness of will, not intemperance. His first-order desire motivates him to go for the drug. Now, of course, there isn't a temperate level of drug taking or cigarette smoking, But we could change the example to one where an agent is contemplating helping himself to another slice of cake. The agent who does not want to be seen as a greedy person forms a second order volition not to act on his first order desire to eat more cake. If he succeeds in not eating more cake, is he temperate or is he self-controlled? The problem is that on Frankfurt's account, reason leaves its mark in the formation of second order desires and volitions. But the effectiveness of the volition still depends on the agent's strength of will. In typical cases of weakness of will, the agent's action goes against his better judgment, and this is what happens if the agent takes more cake, despite his second order preferences. So what is temperance on this model? On Frankfurt's account, in order to be an agent, one has to have second order attitudes regarding first order desires. One has to make some desires one's own, and if one acts on a desire that one prefers not to have, the desire will be external to one's will. If temperance is distinguished from self-control, temperance would not be a case where the first order desire has to be overcome by one's strength of will, but a case where the desire no longer motivates. Given my view that of desire is essentially motivational, this will require that the desire no longer exists. However, I have pointed out that temperance only requires that one's desire does not cause one to take too much of a thing, and not that one does not desire the thing at all. So, Frankfurt's account leaves no room for temperance as I understand it. We need an account that explains an essentially motivating desire's failure to motivate, where what prevents the motivation is neither something beyond in the world, beyond one's control, nor the exercise of self-control in the form of a struggle to suppress the desire. Now, I think Frankfurt and his followers are mistaken in their assumption that desires have to be endorsed to be one's own. I just find it very strange that you have to endorse your own desires. Desires that one finds oneself with are already your own. Regardless of whether one has second-order preferences about them, one's desire can constitute one's identity, and one can be responsible for what they motivate. Some elements in a person's mental life, such as itches and pains, do not have moral significance. Unendorsed desires that simply occur in a person's life may seem like itches and pains because of the way they originate, but they can still have moral significance. In Aristotle's account of temperance, okay, so I'm stuck, I need a model, right? All three models I've examined don't work, so let's go back to Aristotle. In Aristotle's account of temperance, a distinction is made between natural desires that are general and particular desires. This is in Book 3, Chapter 11 of the Nicomachean Ethics. An example of the former of natural desires is the desire for food. Aristotle observes that few people actually go wrong with this desire because there's a natural limit for the replenishment of a desire, of a deficiency. That is, with respect to natural desires, temperance does not require much effort or training. Okay? Everyone knows when they're full, right? Everyone knows when they're no longer hungry. Actually, we wouldn't make the same observation of eating behavior in today's society. But I think the point is that almost everyone knows what the limit is beyond which one is eating to excess. So one does not have to go through a process of second-order reflection or cost-benefit analysis in order to find the point at which a desire begins to motivate one to excess. A temperate person is one whose desire stops motivating at that point. A person requires self-control only if his desires continue to motivate beyond the point. Frankfurt is right that self-control requires reflection on one's desires. But in generalizing to all actions, his account leaves no room for temperance. Now, there are at least two ways in which what I said will seem unsatisfactory. First, it seems that I have overgeneralized in the opposite direction, for not all desires are like the desire for food. Aristotle acknowledges that particular desires may not have a natural limit. Second, an account of temperance in terms of natural limits of desire seems to have left out the role of reason. But temperance is a virtue, and in Aristotle's account, all virtues are governed by rational principles. I can respond to both worries by examining the process by which a person acquires virtues. As a virtue of character, temperance is concerned with the appetitive part of the soul and is acquired through habituation. Although the desire for food has a natural limit, the motivating force of the desire may not terminate at that point. It may fall short, or more likely, it may lead to excess. It is a process of habituation, with the guidance of those experienced enough to tell us what counts as excess, that trains the desire to motivate to the natural limit and not beyond. Now the point is, particular desires can also be habituated. One has to learn from experience what is too much or too little, and those with experience can guide one to act correctly. The point about natural limits is that with the desire for food, there is a point at which the deficiency is met. One is no longer hungry. With particular desires, what is excessive varies with circumstances, including your resources, and with individual traits. Contrast, for instance, what counts as excessive in the acquisition of philosophy books. Okay, that's a particular desire, not a general natural desire, and there's no natural limit, right, in the acquisition of philosophy books. But consider what counts as excessive for a student, a general reader, and a professional philosopher. Okay, what's excessive is different for each of them. With particular desires, it takes more experience to find the limit in a process that will involve both hits and misses. And the limit may vary between persons and for the same person at different times. Right, the student, the general reader, and the professional philosopher might well be the same person at different times. So, as Aristotle notes, it is easier to go wrong with particular desires. But there is a right amount of the thing that one desires, which a person with sufficient experience is more capable of locating. So it's still the same process. It's important to recognize that there is a role of reason in all this. Habituation is not a mindless process. Okay, some people think of habituation as just blind, okay, a mindless process. Habituation is not mindless, even if it does not involve the kind of practical reasoning that full-fledged virtuous agents may, in their reflective moments, carry out. In rival moral theories, practical reasoning has been construed as either a form of cause-benefit analysis or as reasoning from ultimate deontological principles. Okay? Practical reasoning is in fact discussed in almost every moral theory, but it takes different forms in different moral theories. In virtue ethics, moral reasoning does not take either of the earlier forms. It's not cost-benefit analysis, it's not reasoning from ultimate principles. Although fully virtuous agents choose virtue for its own sake, in view of a conception of the human good, agents can exercise their reason before they are fully virtuous by making moral choices, not about the ends, but about the means to achieve their goals. This is a kind of lower-level moral reasoning, which I suggest requires the agent to have a second-order desire regarding the choice of means, but not that he has made a choice of ultimate ends from which he reasons particular actions. Okay, I've discussed this distinction between moral reasoning about means and moral reasoning about ends in other works that I've done. It seems strange that if the only form of moral reasoning is that of the fully virtuous agent who have already knows what the human good is, then it's clearly a case that even in the process of acquiring virtues, you are doing moral reasoning. If I'm right, there's a level of moral reasoning that is based on the innate preferences of persons, and which can be found in agents who have not yet made deep moral choices. This would be an intermediate stage of moral reasoning that could be a step in the process of moral education. My evidence for such moral reasoning is that agents can have reason not to do actions that are in their and everyone's supposedly best interest, simply because they see it as morally wrong. Such choices are not irrational. Examples would range from the official who refuses to torture a suspect to prevent an act of terrorism, to someone who realizes that he's trying to have too much of a thing, no matter that he still desires it. The latter person will be recognizing the limit for this desire. And if he continues to exercise restraint whenever he recognizes such limits, he is well on his way to temperance. In this paper, I have examined various models of rational choice to identify the best model of temperance. One that can explain how temperance is achieved, and one that can also be used to distinguish temperance as a virtue that is superior to mere self-control. The forms of reasoning proposed in the second and third model, there's constraint maximization and second order desires, do not exhaust the possibilities for moral reasoning. Although some people may indeed weigh costs and benefits of cooperation against alternatives, and some people form second order volitions to evaluate their first order motivations, temperance does not involve either forms of reasoning. I suggested another way in which reason is involved in the choices of a temperate agent, which I think is more in line with Aristotle's views, and which can also be used to explain why temperance is not just self-control. The view that I presented is one in which a person becomes temperate as a result of his moral training and character. A temperate person does not have to exercise self-control because his desires do not motivate him when he has the right amount of a thing. That's just the kind of person he is. He does not have to make calculations about which desires to satisfy. If he has a problem telling what the limit for the satisfaction of a desire is, or if he has to struggle to get his desires to stop motivating him when the limit is reached, then he is someone who lacks the virtue of temperance. Thank you. Okay, so I think I will take questions to 10:22, so yes, please.
Yeah, and I understand you opposed self-control to temperance, to the virtue. That's not my reading of Aristotle, and maybe I'm not saying you're wrong, but my reading is that the virtue is a habit of self-control, acquiring self-control by habituation, acting rationally according to the need by habit. I go back to considering self-control in the Facebook of the Republic, Plato talks about self-mastery, self-control. He said it seems like a contradiction because if I'm the master of myself, I'm also the slave of myself. How can that be? Or like the more noble part, reason rules the lower part. That would be what he considers self-control. So if reason is controlling what I do and my desires, that would be self-control.
Okay.
This is not a struggle to do it.
In Aristotle's ethics, temperance and self-control are completely different because he discusses weakness of will in Book 7 of the Nicomachean Ethics, but he discusses the virtue of temperance in Book 3. I would think that there's also a distinction between temperance and self-control in Plato, because when you are fully virtuous and temperate in the Plato's tripartite account of the soul, the appetites or desires would recognize and accept the rule of reason. So they would not be struggling against reason.
They would struggle to have self-control, my point. I think they have self-control without struggle.
So I think we're in agreement that if you are still having to exercise self-control, you are not yet there. Because when you're there, when you're fully temperate, there's no need to struggle because desire will submit to reason. As opposed, so the idea of self-control is that even when reason makes a judgment that you have had enough, don't take that slice of cake, the desire is still pushing you to do it, so that if you do not watch out, right, you will succumb to a weakness of will and you take the cake. But the point is the temperate person would not even have to struggle with himself. When he reaches the point where it's enough, he stops.
But that's self-control. You don't have to have a struggle to exercise self-control. All you have to do is be guided by reason. Sometimes it's a struggle, but the virtuous person is guided by reason without a struggle.
Yeah, I don't see temperance that way. I think John McDowell doesn't see it that way. And my paper is actually an attempt to articulate this difference that John McDowell, in the quote that I provided right at the beginning. And John McDowell is interpreting Aristotle at that point.
My interpretation of Aristotle is based on part of the fact that he was a student of Plato. He studied under Plato. He discussed it with Plato. So I see his thought as a reflection on Plato's, not always in agreement, but with modification, changes. But in Plato, the temperance is when you have the well-ordered state. It's not when you're having to use force to subdue the two lower classes, but when everything's working in harmony. Then you have the temperance being exercised, the harmony between the rulers and the rule. Whereas you seem to think that only if there's a struggle can there be self-control. It's only when you have to move in the stormtroopers to keep the people down. And Plato said that's not a temperance statement. They're not working in harmony.
Thank you. Was there a hand up? Go ahead.
The way I understand what you're saying is self-control is the process that you're going through to reach temperance. When you reach temperance, there is no struggle. There is no thinking that needs to be done because you become being in the world. You just do what's right because it's within your being. There is no thinking process at this point in time because you don't need to struggle anymore.
Okay. Yes and no.
Okay.
Self-control is different, but I do not see it as part of the process of getting
to.
Don't
see it as part of the process.
Yeah, so your character training and your habituation,
right,
and your moral training is what will get you to become a temperate person. What I'm actually saying is that a temperate person doesn't need self-control.
Right.
And if you are showing self-control, then you're in trouble, right?
Right, that's what I'm saying. I'm saying when you reach temperance, self-control is gone.
Yeah.
Because you are being in the world. It's just part of who you are.
Right, that's your character.
You become who you are in becoming fully human.
Right, so you fulfill your human potential.
Right, there is no thinking in that because you just be in the world.
Yes.
As a human, fully human.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's right. Was there a hand? I don't know who was first.
Yeah.
I just came back to the earlier comment about the difference between temperance and self-control. And maybe the problem is with the English translation that temperance is translating sophrosune and self-control is translating enkrateia. And certainly in Aristotle there is a distinction between those two. But in English, self-control, I think in English we would say that temperance does involve some kind of control. It's just not that kind of control which involves a struggle. It's where reason controls the appetites, but in such a way that the appetites are perfectly in conformity with reason and there's no resistance. So maybe the disagreement is just one of words, that the problem is with the translation, and we could use maybe continence as an alternative translation. But I think you're right that in Aristotle there clearly is this distinction between the virtue and something which falls short of the virtue but is still praiseworthy to some extent. So I don't think it sort of challenges your reading of Aristotle. There is a substantive issue here. How do we distinguish temperance from this other state, which is something less from temperance?
Thank you. I think there's an excellent suggestion that the language thing. You're probably right that when we think of temperance nowadays, like the temperance movement, it seems to be a movement to train people to show self-control. Yeah.
Well, actually, you made that point. I wasn't going to comment on the translations because I'm not familiar with the Greek, but I was going to say it seems that I wanted to press what we meant by self-control, because kind of what some of the other comments, it seems that if a person is going to be temperate and exercise reason, that is some form of control done by the self, and it doesn't seem that it has to be this white knuckling, you know, awful, arduous struggle. But the other point I wanted to ask is, do you think that Aristotle suggests that it's once a person becomes temperate, they're always temperate? Is it the static state? Or are there moments when we go back to having to struggle a little bit to get back here? Because that seems to be maybe a better reading of the human condition, that even the most temperate person may, on occasion, have those moments of struggle. Maybe not a lot, maybe not frequently, maybe not a great struggle, but I'm just wondering if this level of temperance is really a static condition for humans.
That's a good question. In fact, one of the central criticisms of those critics of virtue ethics raise is the question of whether the virtuous person can ever do a wrong action. Because virtue ethics basically says that the right action is what the virtuous person would do, so it looks like the virtuous person can do no wrong. Okay, and in fact, if you have this conception of virtuous agent, that seems too idealistic, right? It's not only a question of whether someone who's temperate can act intemperately, but whether anyone could ever get there. I mean, how many of us would get to the state where we are not tempted at all, right? So it seems to be too high a requirement. I think actually Aristotle is more realistic than that, because I always tell my students that that's the difference between Aristotle and Plato. Aristotle pays attention to the world. Okay, so he's a great observer, right? I mean, in the Nicomachean Ethics, right at the beginning, he talks about King Priam, right? He talks about how a virtuous person, King Priam of Troy, right, could actually become unhappy and become tempted to do bad actions just because of circumstances of the world. So virtue cannot, it's not something that once you reach there you can sit back and relax, right? Because there's always a danger that new situations will come up and you could actually end up losing your virtue. So it's entirely possible, I think, for the temperate person if it's not temperate. Sometimes probably, I mean, especially in particular desires, right? You might be temperate and then suddenly you acquire a new particular desire where you don't know what the limit is, right? And then you have to learn to be temperate with respect to the new desire. So you can imagine someone who's leading a nice temperate life and then he suddenly has this new obsession, right? He discovered playing poker on the internet, and then you can't stop yourself. So that could very well happen.
I just had a quick point of clarification. Do you see there being an association between the distinction between temperance and self-control as related to Aristotle's distinction between self-love and selfishness? Between self-love and selfishness. The desire for things that are good for you as opposed to the desire for
I have to think about that, but that's a good question, and I think I need to turn over to Laura, so we could have more discussion later. Sorry, I want to make sure that Laura has a share. Okay.
Last question. I have one more. I like your paper. When it comes to desires which don't have a natural limit, I'm wondering whether perhaps self-control is all that is available. You know, I'm a little surprised you're holding on to this idea that for all the desires there are, eventually we have to aspire to temperance. But perhaps if the natural limit is not available, right, then I don't think the state of temperance might be possible. Because if a desire doesn't have a natural limit, what am I going to aim for, right? You speak to life experience and so on, but it seems, ultimately speaking, the cutoff point for these desires seems to be somewhat arbitrary, and eventually I think the state we're in would strikes me as being more like self-control and not temperance. So that's the worry I had about you. Do you see what I'm...
Yes, thank you. I think I should think more about that, because it seems like, from what you're saying, that there's a possibility I haven't examined, which is that Frankfurt's model, which I say, of a second order endorsement, which I say is not applicable, might actually be applicable to particular desires.
Exactly.
But not to the natural desires.
Right.
Yeah, so thanks for the suggestion. Okay. Laura, go ahead.
Oh, yeah.
My proposal is concerning working in progress, and that needs to be polished as far as the technical details, and it's called Grid, Character, and Morality. Grid is clearly a deficiency of character, but philosophers disagree about what constitutes a correct description of it. Particularly troubling to Aristotle's commentators is the relationship between greed and fairness in distribution. Urson claims that Aristotle makes two mistakes as a result of which his treatment of justice as well as greed are inadequate. I explore his position and indicate where I think he's mistaken. I conclude that in searching for illuminating descriptions of greed, we may have to move beyond the priorities of exegesis and to go back to the basic question of an account's power to represent what is the case. Brunson claims that Aristotle is mistaken in treating justice as an excellence of character and is seeking to match each different excellence of character with a different emotion. These mistakes are not of the same order. Concerning the second point, Urmson does think that Aristotle's mistake resides in confusing a false theory for the truth, namely, the theory that for every excellence of character, there is a different emotion. He thinks this theory is false. But concerning the first point, it is not clear what kind of mistake Aristotle is arguably making. To say that Aristotle wrongly treats particular justice as an excellence and gets into problems he cannot solve is, of course, to say that Aristotle is mistaken, but it doesn't tell us whether the mistake consists in adopting a false or a distorted view of justice and greed, or in becoming entangled in a structural problem rooted in the frame of reference used. The first possibility suggests that Aristotle's mistake was to think that justice is an excellence of character when indeed this is false. The second possibility suggests that he was misled by the false theory that for every excellence there is a different emotion. Urmson agrees with the second possibility. He thinks that the theory linking excellences of character with particular emotions is false. But he does not claim that justice is not an excellence of character, or that it is false or wrong to believe it is. I am inclined to interpret him as claiming not that justice is not an excellence of character, but only that Aristotle cannot treat it on the model used for excellences of character. This is indeed true, as Aristotle does not succeed in treating justice in this way. That Aristotle runs into problems he cannot solve is widely acknowledged, but it is not the same as claiming that his account of justice is mistaken and that justice is unrelated to an excellent character. The first problem is a deficiency in his framework, but commits Aristotle to no faulty account of reality, whereas the second mistake is substantive and implies that Aristotle has a distorted understanding of justice and of the forms taken by deviations from justice. Ernson argues that greed should not be understood as a perversion of the desire for a first share in the distribution of goods in society, and takes Aristotle's failed efforts to the contrary as providing crucial evidence for this. There is, Ernson claims, no specific emotion or desire distinctively and uniquely associated with particular justice and its deficient extreme, or with the fair and unfair distribution of goods. Ernson proposes instead to keep the description of the emotional greed separate from the account of particular justice. And along these lines, greed is not uniquely associated with any one excellence of character because the emotion it is may have different objects, notably honor in the case of vanity and money in the case of greed, or material resources in the case of greed. In this way, greed is taken to provide a counterexample to the thesis that every excellence of character is uniquely associated with a different emotion. Ernson is right in calling attention to the special status of justice and in insisting that this property is primarily a feature of distributions rather than a property of the agents that design them. But a sense of justice surely is part of what an excellent person's character has, and lack of sensitivity or regard for justice surely is a defect and not a positive feature, regardless of whether or not one has the framework to correctly describe the excellence. The conclusion from this is that the limitations of the frame of reference should not stop us from pursuing the substantive questions that are really important. This point is captured admirably by Wittgenstein in the remark that, I quote, "We predicate of the thing what lies in the method of representing," end of quote. This is from the Philosophical Investigations. Other commentators have pointed out and in ample detail some of the major problems into which Aristotle runs. Rose mentions that in treating just action as a mean between acting unjustly and being unjustly treated, Aristotle confuses two points of view. The first extreme, acting unjustly, is a possibility open to the statesman and the judge, but not to the private citizen who only receives and does not act at all, for he or she doesn't choose or to allocate the resources but merely receives them. On the other hand, only the private citizen can be unjustly treated. The two points of view confused are the taking and the receiving of resources. Another problem with the treatment of justice as an excellence of character is that one of the extremes is not bad or wrong as the model would require. There is, as Ross explains, no selfish instinct towards taking less than one's share, and adopting this course of action is surely not reprehensible. This seriously undermines attempts to treat justice as a mean and indicates that this quality is fundamentally different from the other excellences of character discussed by Aristotle. Why not, I would ask, look at fairness in distribution as a proper concern for others and their share rather than my share, and admitting that an excessive concern with the shareholders leads to undermining one's own needs, admitting also that a deficient or insufficient concern for others and their share leads to greed. Not treating justice and deviations from justice on the model of excellences of character, or not regarding it as an excellence of character, bypasses the difficulties that Aristotle confronted, but brushes aside the real issues. These include the relation between justice and excellence of character, and between greed and deficiencies of justice. the recommendation Ernst makes is purely negative, that is not to treat justice, as an excellence and greed as a deviation from justice. This alternative does not answer substantive questions. It merely sidesteps the difficulties of an incomplete or deficient framework. For this reason, I claim that the Aristotelian account needs supplementation. A new beginning may provide a way out of the past. I propose to start by considering that perhaps, I quote, human well-being is entirely dependent on the well-being of the whole commonwealth of life. This is the claim that Brown and Garber make in an insightful book entitled Right Relationship, Building a Whole Earth Economy. Two crucial ideas here suggest a place from where to start. The first is that human well-being is concerned rather than independent from the life and prospects of other living beings, human and non-human, so that whether one fares well and flourishes as a human being depends on how other living beings fare in their own lives. A satisfactory account of human well-being, therefore, must recognize and illuminate the mutual interdependence of people with one another and with the entire commonwealth of life, and somehow connect conceptually these issues with the ideas of human excellence and character. The second point concerns the special emphasis on community conveyed by the term commonwealth as used to signify not just a political community established to promote the common good rather than the interests of individuals and of a particular class of people, but the common well-being or commonwealth of all that is alive and whose evolutionary heritage and destiny we share with other life forms. The typical employment of the expression commonwealth is meant to exclude the selfish or greedy promotion of the interests of individuals or groups, whereas the extended use excludes promotion of any human interests at the expense of the commonwealth of the community of life as a whole, of which the human community is a part. In both cases, however, there seems to be an emphasis on the common good as contrasted with the good of the individuals. The fact that Aristotle treats ethics as a part of the science of politics shows that he recognizes that individual human beings are members of society, yet it does not indicate our place in the larger and all-encompassing community of life, and the contribution that interdependence beyond political boundaries makes to our well-being and to the whole of life. Aristotle saw clearly that human flourishing has a social and political dimension that is constitutive of it, that the well-being of a person depends on the relationships and activities, participation and prospects as citizens, and not simply on their existence and strength as organisms. Brown and Garber's remark suggests that the full significance of the social and political interdependence that Aristotle so clearly recognized as constitutive of our human well-being transcends the human community insofar as it is connected to the wider commonwealth or common being of life. The new beginning I have suggested is not incompatible with Aristotle's understanding of well-being in the ethical and political writings, but the idea of a robust and all-encompassing interdependency is not fully present in them. I propose that to fully appreciate how this interdependency is constitutive of well-being, we must make reference to relationships and to an ethics anchored in this concept, and that the expression right relationship used by early Quakers and recently revived may offer some promise. Expanding on the early use of the expression, Brown and Garber speak of right relationship as a value and as a standard. I quote, right relationship provides a guiding ethic for people wishing to live fulfilling lives as creative and integrated participants in human society and the commonwealth of life as a whole. The concept of right relationship is important because there cannot be human well-being without being a part or relating in positive ways to the whole community of life. The concept of right relationship is, of course, an evaluative concept, and as the expression immediately indicates, it makes reference to certain relationships rather than to character, which is primarily a feature of individuals and one contributing to their individuation or differentiation. In contrast with this concept, right relationship is a way of standing that tends to preserve the integrity, resilience, and beauty of the parties, especially those of the commonwealth of life, and it can be used as an evaluative term to indicate whether a particular relationship has or lacks this kind of standing. Integrity stresses acknowledgement of the inherent value of life, a feature that Albert Schweitzer called reverence for life. The idea of resilience emphasizes a form of stability not based on having or being in control of the means, as the notion of having personal strength suggests, but based on being integrated into a wholesome community. In The Evolution of Cooperation, Axelrod speaks of robustness as the alternative to strength, presumably to highlight the idea of a trait that leads to endurance rather than to overcoming others. Finally, reference to beauty emphasizes that right relationship includes an aesthetic response to the totality or to the whole of life. Just as there is no simple recipe for or fixed mixture of qualities defining an excellent character in each particular case, there is no simple formula for right relationship, and we must investigate what particular excellences are critical to and distinctive of right relationships, just as Aristotle does concerning the various excellences of character. We want to know what deviations from an assumed point that is excellent threaten the integrity, resilience, and beauty of the commonwealth of life and the very possibility of relationships. I believe that these questions cannot be satisfactorily answered through a philosophical investigation unless we proceed in a way that includes and brings together the methods and insights of economics, psychology, and ecology, and a non-reductionist emphasis on relations, networks of relations, and systems or totalities. Human well-being cannot be achieved either individually or collectively without excellent relationships that foster integrity, resilience, and beauty. In this sense, human well-being requires right relationship. But the concepts are more deeply connected still. For human beings, for human well-being is not possible and not even imaginable outside the commonwealth of life, only within the whole web of life. A consequence of this is that human well-being is always conditional and limited by our mutual cooperative agreements or the lack of them. This is to say that human well-being is not possible but in right relationship. Another consequence is that well-being is, as Aristotle very clearly saw, an achievement, that it involves activity and, in our case, cooperation. I have not intended to dismiss the objections raised by able commentators to Aristotle's treatment of greed as a perversion of justice, but to prevent the loss of a perspective that I think is crucial for the understanding of greed however difficult it may be for us to give a satisfactory account of it along the lines provided by Aristotle. Woolman correctly saw what seems to me the essential issue and in Quaker fashion expressed it in simple but powerful words. I quote, that much less than we demand would supply us with all things really needful. I propose to go back to thinking of greed as a deficiency, yet to embrace the challenge of illuminating how it is incompatible with excellence of character and with right relationship. Woolman's remark suggests a course, and I hope to have indicated some of the concepts and questions that need to be undertaken. I would like to close by suggesting that just as having virtuously acting virtuously constitutes a happy life rather than being a means to a distinct end of living a happy life, so standing in right relationship to others and to the whole community of life is also constitutive of well-being rather than merely contingent to it. Greed is a powerful impediment to right relationship, not only because of the inordinate of the desire that fills it, but because it is antithetical to the proper concern for others and how they fare that is characteristic of justice. Somehow, we ought to be able to say that greed undermines justice by undermining right relationship and that this is incompatible with excellence of character.
Question, and you're quite correct. I agree that classical economics is basically based on greed, that it recommends to get as much as you can for as long as you can. So this would be in speaking of economics, I mean broadly conceived political economy that works for life rather than for the individual interests of each one of people.
So Marxist sort of economics or socialist economics or under?
I see different perspectives as possible alternatives. Once again, Woolman has in very long time ago developed some ideas in this direction. For example, the idea that an economics that serves the commonwealth of life would have to retreat from abstractions and go back to, for example, looking to the labor that is put into the making or the providing of all of the things and the services that we enjoy. And that a better measure of the real value of things is how much labor they took. And that's a very, that idea is compatible with Marx, but they came to it from different perspectives. Also, there are notions from ecology now coming into the picture. For example, the idea that we have to learn how to think of the real value of things also in terms of the blueprint, the carbon blueprint that is caused in their production. But what impact on the environment
producing something costs, and that has to be figured into the value.
I would rather take exception with the idea that classical economics is based on greed. I think you're confusing the self-interest and greed. Like they're not the same thing. Who was the British writer that wrote, when my son eats his lunch, he's not acting greedily, it's only when he eats his sister's lunch too. Couldn't anybody agree?
Who was that from?
That was the original.
Would like to say about that is that in principle, within classical economics, there is no reason to think that there has to be a stop to on that is to growth and to accumulation.
It should be based on reasonable self-interest. The question is, what's in your self-interest? At what point?
The drive towards growth, unlimited growth and accumulation has to stop, you're quite right, has to be or calls for exercising reason, but what I am saying is that that is not in itself built into the system, it comes from the outside. So at the very least, economics as classically understood needs to be tempered, I guess.
Be governed by ethics.
By ethics, yeah.
I don't confuse economics with ethics. If you think economics operates totally on its own, then you've got a problem. It has to be governed by ethics. And if you understand classical economics as seeking self-interest, or seeking your own self-interest, then the question is, what is your true self-interest? And greed is not in your self-interest. It's a self-destructive behavior, and socially destructive behavior, which is not in your self-interest.
Yes, but I don't think that within the parameters and the constraints provided by the economy, there is any reason for not continuing.
Economics is not autonomous.
It's not autonomous, that's right. And maybe one of the things that insistence on the notion of right relationship may contribute to bring is that very idea that economics is not autonomous. Sometimes we do act, it seems to me, as if it was. Or decisions I make as if it was. And that's what
we hear all the time, that science is, you know, can do whatever it wants. Well, science is not autonomous either. It has to be governed by ethical considerations. Mm-hmm. Just because we do something scientifically doesn't mean it's ethically right.
That's right.
And the same thing with economics. I don't see that it's inherently greedy. Because, in fact, I think it's anti-greed if it's rightly understood. Because greed is self-destructive, ultimately. So,
well,
not in your self-interest to be greedy.
It is based on individuals competing with each other, and it has little to say about relationship. It's the individual is the and his or her interests is the unit of analysis.
And we have seen recently what happens with excessive self-interest when it's carried beyond reason. It becomes socially and self-destructive. I mean, the bankers are losing money because they're too greedy.
Yes.
They took risks they shouldn't have taken and so forth, and you go on. But that wasn't in their self-interest. They had mistaken ideas about what was their self-interest.
Was Robin Hood right? Like the pirates that are taking over these ships, are they right or wrong? When they pass through that channel, are they right or wrong? Robbing from the...
Are you asking, are they in right relationship to the rest? Oh.
Is it right or wrong?
That's who I'm coming from.
Right.
Well, one thing that I am suggesting is that we ask, is that in line with respecting and promoting the resiliency of everything that is, or is it antagonistic to life? to use that as at least part of the standard by which to judge in that case.
If I rob and keep it, it's wrong, but if I rob and give it away, is it right?
Is it ever right to take something away from someone else that doesn't really belong to you? Is that ethical? I mean, whether you agree or not with, I'm not attacking you, but I'm just saying in general, whether you agree or not with an action, whether it's politically motivated or economically motivated, however, is it ethically right to take something that doesn't belong to you because you think you're doing it for an admirable or ethical or moral cause? It still does not belong to you, to me, is the foundational statement. It does not belong to you. Therefore, you have no right to it.
I agree. And I think that another way of making the point is to say that it is from the very beginning relation undermining.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you put it very well. I think that's, you said it much better than I. That's undermining it, you know, because you think you have a right to something that doesn't belong to you. I'm taking from the rich to give to the poor, Robin Hood or whatever the case may be. It still does undermine the fabric of the community.
Right.
So thanks for your paper. I found the emphasis on right relationship very interesting. You talked a bit about, you know, obviously the relationship between justice and right relationship. And justice is a kind of a virtue of right relationship. Is temperance a virtue of right relationship? And what is the relationship between temperance and justice? I suppose those are my two questions.
Mm-hmm. Very difficult and very good questions. I think it's really the connection between temperance and justice is really problematic in Aristotle. It's a very difficult point in his account. My own view is that yes, temperance is one of the conditions of possibility, as it were, for right relation. Yes, and that both temperance and right relation bring justice, but how conceptually to work out all the connections is what I am still trying to figure out.
Maybe it's a good, again, ending point. I'm totally uninformed for thought, but I heard you express in your emphasis on right relationship, integration, robustness, resilience, beauty, and is there an emphasis on totality?
Yes, because of the reference to commonwealth of life.
Of life.
Yes, so the community of life taken as a totality or as a whole. As contrasted with the view that sees a group or as an aggregate, simply as an aggregate of its individual members. So that's totality, yes, and attitudes towards that community as a totality or as a whole.
It's interesting to me, so I've heard this notion of resilience deployed going kind of almost exactly the opposite to some of the things you're talking about, because the way I've come into familiarity with this notion is that the earth indeed can be resilient, life can be resilient, especially once the humans are gone. You know, if you advance the time frame, this is exactly some strange arguments I've come into, but I thought it's a unique topic there. It's an anthropocentric, in other words, like this notion of life. Is it over, or anyway, it's an unformed thought, but that's the question.
That we are not, that is an anthropomorphizing way of looking at nature to speak of the need for resilience.
it comes into that for me. It's unformed, but.
Brown and Garber are indicating here, and they trace it back to Leopold, Albert Leopold, is the idea of strength gained from interdependency, and that is ultimately strength based on community, as contrasted with individual strength. And they prefer the word resiliency because, as conveying the point better than strength. Strength being more something that invites images of the individual resisting, for example, external pressures and doing well on his own or on her own.
Yeah, I've been coming for the last 2 years.
So I think temperance is a one-partner or two, and I think I'm going to be easier. Because most of us have experienced continence. Very few of us have experienced continence. And he spends almost a whole book on goodness and will, but three chapters, three
chapters.
It's always a problem for goodness you at are they really these people? But they must be, because we were supposed to have moral examples that we would look up to.
So there's got to be somebody.
Yeah.
Which goes back to your question about what it would like to be wrong.
I think you're right.
If we use means to try to model myself after, like you're saying, I do
But there is a danger in seeing someone as
well. I don't think all the great, not all the great.
Especially if you're the whole point of watching them is that your judgment has
been made. You brought it up. That's how I read. Okay.
Try to avoid moral life.
Thank you.
Even in intrinsic the schools when children do something wrong, right? We try to explain it as a disease, right? ADHD or
right, exactly. That's why I thought it was
so, you know, and if somebody doesn't want to say it, because I can't
teach them right and wrong. Well, and not only that,
questions
we'll move on to
times, actually.
Okay, good. So we may do that. We'll take a few questions after this, and then we'll move on to Joseph
Katie.
Katie.
Yeah.
From St. Mary's. We've just discovered we are in the same town. I live in Winona. Mm-hmm. Someone from St. Mary's was here today. So you guys are going to start with Professor Hannah.
Humility barely merits a cameo in the popular psychodrama. Dr. Phil doesn't give it much play, nor for those who remember Dr. Ruth. The best members of their tribe might counsel the rooting out of false humility as a step towards self-esteem. But humility fares no better in the credentialed groves of the academy. Harvard began with a salute to veritas, but no university chisels humilitas on the facade of a library. Nor would David Hume or Friedrich Nietzsche lament humility's eclipse. For Hume, humility is a monkish virtue. For Nietzsche, it is the nearest pose. The psalmist avows, I am a worm and no man. Even so, Nietzsche sniffs out self-interest. Well, when stepped on, a worm doubles up. And that way, he lessens the probability of being stepped on again. In the language of morality, humility. Perhaps such philosophers need a poet's help. Might not a worm be still cannier than Nietzsche thought? Joseph Plunkett, not O. Plunkett, but nonetheless a leader in Ireland's Easter Uprising of 1916, puts back to another Joseph, one who wore a coat of many colors, having referenced the psalmist. Plunkett writes, the worm is clad in plated mail and rides upon the envious earth. His power prevails and shall prevail, and death gleans in the fields of birth. Salutary insight, but should philosophers take lessons from a poet, even about the wiles of a worm? Plunkett, in any case, has allies. St. Augustine asks, do you propose to raise the great fabric of high virtue? Then attend first to the foundation of humility. To this end, St. Bernard of Clairvaux authored The Steps of Humility and Pride. Though a monk, Bernard was scarcely mild and preached a crusade, some of whose participants mangled Augustine's criteria for a just war. Perhaps poets should beware of monks, especially if monks make war. In this regard, diplomats are worse than monks. Here, a not-so-idle question comes to mind. If philosophers could learn from poets, might diplomats learn from monks? Think of the diplomatic machinations just prior to World War I. At that very time, Raphael Cardinal Mary Belval, Secretary of State for Pius X, wrote a litany of humility. At once a monk and a diplomat, he praised therein that he neither desired that others consult him nor fear their ridicule. Enough preliminaries. Just what is this humility that comes with both cultured despisers and saintly advocates? Its mixed review suggests a problematic structure. Sure, other virtues puzzle us. a comparison shows as much. When families spin into a societal freefall, filial piety might offer us a point of reference. Yet we are unsure about what counts as filial piety. Some even deny that it is a virtue. Humility seems harder still to fathom. At least we can link filial piety with justice between generations, and doing so gives us a start. Is not justice our theme 2 years ago, the one virtue that commands our attention? Despite our puzzlement about humility, Thomas Aquinas might be of help in a retrieval of humility. Sed caveat auditor, Aquinas, author of the hymn Panis Angelicus, was a poet and a monk, as well as a philosopher theologian. He was also diplomat enough to decidedly nuance his analysis of regicide. After all, his brother was executed for insurrection. Aquinas analyzes humility in terms of its function. He locates it tucked away, it might seem, within temperance. Why does he do so? Temperance serves reason, the measure of every virtue, by arresting the surge of the passions. Humility, in particular, serves to temper and restrain our creaturely pursuit of human goods. The will, rather than the intellect, puts humility into play, yet reason tells us why we need humility. For Aquinas, the virtues work in harmony. So, not surprisingly, courage, our theme last year, stiffens our spirit in the face of the fear that jeopardizes our pursuit of the human good. Of interest, too, is that Aquinas locates magnanimity within courage. Both virtues help us to act with right reason. Nonetheless, Aquinas explains that although, quote, the knowledge of one's own deficiency is a prerequisite, quote, humility itself essentially lies in appetite, which it serves to modulate. Yet humility is other-regarding as well as self-regarding, since humility bespeaks, quote, the reverence which bows down before God. It follows that, quote, in respect to that which is his own, each ought to defer to that which is God's in anyone. But something of God is in every person, indeed in everything whatsoever. Everything that is, insofar as it is, points to ipsum esse subsistens. Thus, humility, rightly understood, calls us both to a distinctive democracy of the spirit and a sacramental stewardship of the earth. Such claims need charting. To begin, ethics is about the choices we make, the actions which they shape, and the persons we thus become. Of course, it is one thing to make a choice and another to act on it. Indeed, in some cases, it is hard even to make a choice, and harder still to act on it. Much depends on the kind of persons we have made ourselves to be. To choose and act well calls on the strength of one's character. In fact, a whole range of such strengths are the moral virtues. Consider justice and courage. Justice comes into play in the context of giving each person his or her due, and in doing so, one acts well. One who is courageous acts well in the face of fear. Such justice and such courage are a matter of practice, not theory. But what is it to act well in every context and throughout one's life? It is to act in harmony with the dynamic core of being human. It is to act in accord with reason. But being human is a work in fitful progress, and acting in harmony with reason is often a struggle. In this combat, every virtue comes into play. Enter temperance. It does not dispute justice's primacy, nor does temperance come with trumpets of courage, yet there is nothing stingy or cringing about temperance. No, it is better that we think of forged iron and tempered steel. Temperance comes into play in the context of desires that threaten to overcome reason. Temperance challenges and directs those desires so that they can instead strengthen reason. Among our contending desires is a desire for excellence. That is, as a recruiter of young dreams might say, to be all that we can be. Now, what is this all that we can be? It would seem folly to settle for less, though often we do. It would seem folly to try to be more, though often we do. For Aristotle, the good man can achieve happiness, a reasoned ordering of human goods. That is, the good man can do so given luck and the virtues, among them temperance. Thus, Aristotle famously defines happiness as rational activity of the soul in accordance with excellence or virtue, and if there are many excellences, then in accordance with the best of them. Aquinas, in contrast, thought we could be more than Aristotle's good man, whatever our luck. He thought that given grace, the good man and the good woman could live well and come to share in God's life. This grace is a free gift, but it supposes that one is kapax dei, that is able to receive it. Aquinas thought that Aristotle was instructive with respect to the natural virtues, but scarcely anticipated the theological virtues. How stands it then with every man in the eyes of Aquinas? How stands it with us? Often we settle for less than we can be, and doing so, we often give way to fear. We need courage. We need magnanimity, that is, high-mindedness. Other times, with equal perversity, we aim for more than we can be. Doing so, we are presumptuous. We need temperance, in particular, humility. To be virtuous, we must be both high-minded and humble. We also need to look beyond Aristotle. He misrepresents the former, conflating it with an appearance of gravitas and keenness for public honors, and he is unaware of the latter. Now, human beings are by nature social, even political, so we must be high-minded and humble with respect to those with whom we live. But there is more. For Aquinas, we live as God's creatures. Above all, then, our desires are in harmony with the real. They are reasonable. Insofar as the excellence we desire is a community that shares in God's own life. It is out of reverence to God that humility guards against our claiming anything separate from the source of our hope. In these interesting times, to be sure, every man lives neither in the Athens of Aristotle nor in the Paris of Aquinas. Every man and woman lives today, and today we are mostly postmodern or aspire to be. Alistair MacIntyre has written perceptively about us, suggesting even that a new Saint Benedict might have much to offer us. In the Rule of Saint Benedict, we can find an analysis of humility and its degrees, but we're not likely to consult that rule. After all, we're mostly secular, we're mostly bourgeois. We're secular in that we have fallen into a disenchantment in which we no longer believe in many gods and hesitate to believe in one. We're bourgeois, much as Rousseau said, that is, we are power-grabbing and money-loving, yet risk-averse and respectability craving. We follow our opinion leaders, the most visible of whom MacIntyre identifies, aesthetes, managers, therapists. How then might courage, especially as high-mindedness and temperance, especially as humility, come into play in these interesting times? We must look sharp especially for humility. Courage on occasion moves center stage and takes a bow, but how is temperance to do so? Temperance enters neither from stage right nor from stage left. If it enters at all, it is with caution, and it takes no cue from opinion leaders. The aesthete, after all, seeks the pleasures of the moment. But surely one may seek and give more. How then can the aesthete be magnanimous? Nor does the aesthete temper the appetites of the moment, since it is the moment in which the aesthete lives. And their position, he denies both past and future. Pretending to be a thief of time, how can the aesthete be humble? And what of the manager? He or she is wholly given over to the efficient use of means to realize a range of ends that have already been assigned. How then could the manager be magnanimous unless acting so would be efficient? And even then, paradoxically, doing so would discount the action from being magnanimous, for efficiency demands the suitable and the calibrated. Nor does the manager temper his or her artificial appetite for efficiency. To do so would be self-defeating. Full efficiency brooks no interference. How then can the manager be humble? And the therapist. The therapist sets out to heal. That is, to return the patient to normal life. But to heal a patient who is mostly secular and mostly bourgeois is to help the patient manage the misery of secular and bourgeois life. Post-Freudian times, it is especially to help the patient is chemically compromised, whether the cause is organic or reflects consumer preference. Thus, the therapist becomes a new sort of manager and technician. But the therapist is a manager of misery and a practical chemist. Is neither magnanimous nor humble. High-mindedness, or the rhetoric thereof, might distract patients from their misery. But for the secular and the bourgeois, edging into oblivion, how can such distraction be sustainable? It becomes a useless token for a trip to nowhere. Humility is useless as well. Humility checks the appetites for power and money and respectability, the appetites which need therapeutic affirmation rather than discipline and restraint. How can a therapist encourage humility? In sum, high-mindedness and humility are not virtues for the aesthete, for the manager, or for the therapist. So far as we are bourgeois and secular, they are not virtues for any of us. Not for us as the lion-hearted ancient. Not for us as the tempered metal of the ancients. Tempered metal invites combat, and the bourgeois prefers comfort. But there's a further twist. Not for us either as scripture's way to glory. We cannot be humble enough to bear it. And why is the soul? Is it because, as Hume warns, humility is a monkish virtue, and they are not monks? No, it is because humility comes into its own against a horizon of the sacred. One need not be a monk to recognize this horizon, and some monks fail to do so. But nonetheless, one might ask, how can such a horizon be a part of public reason or reasonableness? John Rawls, our master theorist of justice, rules them out of bounds in the pure procedural engineering of the political order. To appeal to a sacred horizon is to take a metaphysical turn. Doing so offends the privileged order of liberal polity. That is, of a secular polity with its bourgeois sensibilities. Never mind the weight of glory. Civility, that's what we want. Although often we fail to achieve even this. An objection. There is no lack of objections, I admit, to my brief efforts toward a retrieval of humility. Here I'll consider but one, though it cuts to a Thomist's bone. Why suppose a unity of virtues? Why set out, for example, to reconcile humility with courage? Does not humility dampen ambition even while courage and courage is boldness? East and west might be at meet, but one cannot baptize Aristotle, and surely not in light of his desire. Does not Aquinas set out to do the impossible? Ought not his friends, if they do seek social reconstruction, at least begin to look elsewhere? In reply, this friend suggests that we move from the specific to the more general, if only for a bit. Humility, a form of temperance, serves reason in the regards against striving for what is not ours to realize. High-mindedness, a form of courage, serves reason in that it incites us to strive for what we can realize. So humility and high-mindedness do not conflict, or do they? Courage invites daring, and it seems easier to correct an excess of daring than a deficiency. Humility blocks presumption, and it seems easier to correct one who puts himself forward too little than to correct one who puts himself forward too much. Nonetheless, courage and humility are not in conflict because courage finds its measure in the reason that faces down fear, while humility finds its measure in reverence for God. Well, suppose one admits for now that these virtues do not conflict. Surely their harmony requires the rarest moral equilibrium. One might even argue that passions make such equilibrium impossible. Thus, Shelby Steele recently commented that Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois could not form an alliance because they wore incompatible public masks. Washington was humble, Dubois was outraged. Steele says, one, quote, can't be humble and outraged at the same time. But sometimes righteous anger is warranted. Or was it that Nathan failed in humility when outraged by David's betrayal of Uriah, he indicted his king, saying, thou art the man? More generally, and at the highest metaphysical elevations, Thomists affirm the intelligibility of being. They affirm, too, the unity of the truth and the oneness of the good. They search out a concept in harmony, whether in science or ethics. The harmony of the virtues excludes this conflict. Discipline orchestrates their convergence. Thus, in reply to Augustine's urging that humility is the foundation of all virtue, Aquinas distinguishes in order to unite. Quote, humility makes a man subject to the rule of reason in every field, while the other virtues do this each in its own particular field. Humility does so in that it reorders presumptuous desire to reason, although justice sets its own universal rule by identifying the common good. Yet, after justice, humility is the greatest of the moral virtues. And I owe this qualifier to Joseph Tatey, the greatest of the moral virtues in respect to how we might best order means to an end. Note, too, the contrast between this harmony and the self-destruction of the tragic hero. Nietzsche favored the heroic over the harmonic. The hero resolute courts tragedy while harmony invites false peace. One might even claim that Aristotle held a higher regard for the unrestrained than conventional scholarship suggests. Thus, Patina Nyssa points to Aristotle's claim in the Nicomachean Ethics. Quote, he who claims little is modest or temperate, but not great souled, since to be great souled involves greatness. Yet Aquinas, citing this very assertion, says that, quote, such a one we may well term humble. Just here, indeed, Aquinas might refer us to Mary's Magnificat. My soul magnifies the Lord, she declares, but there's no hubris. Rather, there's joy in that the Lord, boy, has looked with favor on the lowliness of his servant. And because of this, all generations will call me blessed. Who then is great? Not the tragic hero. Only the humble can bear the weight of glory. Chesterton observes that, quote, there is about one who defends humility something inexpressibly rakish. The accolade better fits one who practices humility. Such a one, however, might also be revolutionary and nurturing. Both would express reverence. Joseph Plunkett, the rebel, cared enough for a simple garden to see his Savior's blood upon the rose and his face and every flower. C.S. Lewis, the scholar, knew that caring for one's neighbor and somewhat revolutionary is no easy thing. In his The Way to Glory, he writes, oh, it may be possible for each to think too much of his own potential glory. It's hardly possible for him to think too often or too deeply about that of his neighbor. It's hardly possible to think too often or too deeply about that of his neighbor. My neighbor's glory should be laid daily on my back, a load so heavy that only humility can carry it. It is Lewis, too, who links this potential glory with beauty and does so with reference even to that which is inanimate in nature. If we fail to care for the world around us, we obscure its reflection of the greater. We become complicit in chaos. Indeed, he tells us that the enchantment of those who saw gods everywhere is more primordial than primitive. And best of all, it is anticipatory. From such an enchantment, a sterile modernity might relearn the intimations of beauty. Absent humility, however, we fall into sloth, that is, the Acadia that refuses transcendence. Yet, my sketch of humility and of the virtues which complement and the vices which make it counterfeit, this leads us to metaphysics. For, suppose that God does not exist, that any Thomist account of the virtues collapses. Even Nietzsche would have been right, though they have no last laugh. But then Aquinas never thought that ethics could make do without metaphysics, whether the metaphysics of God or of the humble human embryo, the least of the little ones. His metaphysics of God is more acute than that of the embryo. In that latter regard, Aristotle is a far less reliable starting point. Such questions, of course, are for another time. Thank you.
Things that are mostly secular and bourgeois, a manager of misery, and you mentioned as examples Dr. Phil and Dr. Ruth.
So I don't really see those people
as therapists. Okay, well, good. Because I was going to ask you, is there not another way to imagine healing in a way that isn't a healing that can lead to humility, to imagine healing where the premise is not that everyone is chemically compromised, a way that we can envision healing that, to put it in religious terms, maybe based on a model of Jesus or another appropriate model that isn't about issues of secularity and bourgeoisie. I guess I'm struggling to understand. You have a rather grim assessment of therapy as an enterprise, and Yes. Is there not another way to envision that?
Well, I'm sure there is. I think all the quotes we looked at, by the way, will be all certified close reading and full of grief and triumph and therapeutic, and most latterly, shortly before his death, something called the death works. I think there is, but I think that mainstream credential therapy draws on metaphysics that is resolutely secular, is likely to discourage anything that would be a robust Christian virtue. And I think it's no accident that so many of our students in writing a paper I have to say that they feel this or that, and the object of the feeling is a complex proposition instead of emotion. And the goal is that everybody feel comfortable. It seems to me that any attempt at reading of scripture would lead us to view that it's not our goal on a day-to-day basis to feel comfortable.
It's about right relationship, and I'm suggesting that perhaps that can be a goal of therapeutic intervention.
So long as it's, to use therapeutic talk, engaged in dialogue with Father Zosima of Dostoevsky's work, who says, as Dorothy Day was fond of citing, love and practice is a harsh.
I guess this sort of relates to the previous question. I found really helpful your discussion of the aesthete and the manager and the therapist. Those have always sort of mystified me and McIntyre as to why those. And I think you tell a good story about why they're good characters. But I wonder if you have any thoughts about did McIntyre have to pick those as the characters, or could he just as easily have picked, say, the politician and the professor and the entrepreneur or something like that?
Well, yes, he certainly could have gone in that direction. Nonetheless, I think more and more the esteemed politician is the good technician, which is to say the good manager, who deflects any sharply pointed and sustained criticism of the moral foundations of what he's doing, to wit, a certain president who's about to appear another day. The substantive issues will never be discussed, and I'm sure that Jesuit leadership will counsel civility rather than actual engagement.
Would it be accurate or a misrepresentation of your main position to say that it is important to distinguish between therapy as the practice that it may degenerate into the kinds of things that you say on the one hand, and therapeutic process and the therapeutic effects on the other? I mean, by insisting on the distinction, we could say that there might be activities that are intrinsically therapeutic. I'm thinking of, say, philosophy as leading us to see things in the right way, or to perceive correctly, whereas the practice, the way it is done, may be, you know, affected by all the things that you are denouncing.
Yes, let me try one other response. I think there's an enormous difference between Adrian von Kahn and Abraham Maslow. capacity as you grow older, that you, whether you're in Van Khan, the deeper you grow into yourself, the more possible it is to be Kapok state, open to grace. But I don't think those distinctions were made. And in practice, what's mostly involved is the hustle and bustle of marketing.
I'd like to suggest that there's been an enormous amount of confusion in different provinces have arisen over semantic confusion. When the therapist uses the word normal, he means something very different from what an ethicist or a theologian means. For him, normal means the statistical norm, not the standard, but simply the statistical average. And so, and as a scientist, that's all he can mean by as far as he wants to consider claim to have scientists. He cannot make both value judgments to heal the patient. And so when he talks about normal, you can't take that, as many have, and try to use it as an ethical standard. And I think we've had a lot of problems arising from precisely that difficulty.
Thank you.
Yes,
sir. Why do you think that efficiency is always a good thing for the manager, administrator, because it seems to me that the most efficient way to do things is to forget about the fact that you're dealing with human beings and treat them as numbers or from the sheets. And I don't think that's a good thing at all.
Nor do I. But I think the foundations of our culture and industrial and communicatory life are such that there is an extraordinarily strong pull for efficiency to mean just that. And I don't think that that's going to be changed by restructuring committees or blue ribbon committees. I think that's going to be changed on an individual basis, person by person. I think that change is most likely to be characterized by strategic acts of the body.
Such as?
Enter courage.
You mean, could a strategic act of rebellion come from a manager, say, who decides to practice principles of servant leadership? It grows out of a practical question. About a year ago, because for some reason my name comes up when you search humility, this guy who's doing a PhD in the UK on humility as a practice in business, and he alerted me to this whole body of literature that when you're burrowing into Aquinas, you don't ever come into contact with. But in fact, there is a kind of tradition in even good, he works for a multinational called Fortis. I don't know what their business is, but it was kind of alarming. Maybe I'll direct it
well,
to you.
Well, there is a counter managerial sphere. I recommend Joseph Pierce's recent book, Small is Still Beautiful, Economics as If Families Mattered. And he gives case after case of genuine cooperatives and their struggles against larger sorts of institutions and how precarious it is and how it calls for person number four. Another individual that I think is exemplary in many respects in this regard is Paul Farmer. Some of you have probably read him not too far. And Farmer is at once a researcher at Harvard and a field worker in Haiti and Siberia and other not so appealing places. And he refers to, there's some easy rhetoric on this part, he refers to the TWL, the typical white liberal, and he immediately says that there's plenty of them that aren't white. And what he says is he thinks that the typical white liberal is characterized by someone who thinks that you can make a fundamental change without fundamentally changing yourself. I don't think that can be done. Anybody who moves out of a for-profit, characteristically advanced capitalist corporation and tries seriously to construct something a la Mondragon, Spain, I think that person's life will be pretty much put in upheaval for a good long stretch.
We do need to go ahead and move on to our second speaker.
symmetrical?
Yes.
Seminar all the time, not a very composed lecture. But I want to start, I have three main areas under which I'll talk. The first is just an image that I can't help but relate, thanks to the last talk by Laura and then the one last night. It's a story about, it's an image that I've been using to suggest how I understand humility right now, in this time. I live in this area where you're visiting. It's a unique geological feature on the planet Earth. We were missed by the last sheet of ice. This whole area was a unique refuge. There was a philosopher, economist from the University of Madison, biologist named Aldo Leopold, who did a lot of work in bringing this area into a notion of conservation, trying to take more seriously notions of resilience. How do we, he once remarked, he never knew how dead the upper Midwest, the Driftless area was until he visited the desert of Mexico and saw a living ecology. So the goal was to try to restore some of that. And here he is at the beginning of the, what's typically an easy way to say it, is the beginning of conservation or conservation ecology or conservation restoration ecology, whatever that is, he's somewhat at the source of it. And the alarming thing is, when you start researching more closely into his minor essays, you find a guy, and this guy fits what I would like to assert is a working definition of humility. And it's, that's why I posed the question to you. I'll just tell you, if you can hang with me, this is, I'm trying to cite it. I almost brought it with me, but I thought it would be irrelevant. Now I have to tell you this. He says, look, when I pick up my coffee, he's describing the efforts that we're all going to have to undergo. We're going to have to study agriculture practices, ecology practices, economic practice. All of these things are going to need to be taken seriously to develop a relational understanding. And he says, look, I pick up my coffee and two things happen. A wetland is drained for a cow to get the milk, and the resilient forest is cut down for the rubber. Some birds are going extinct. So I drink coffee, and I'm directly related to these adverse things. He says, I publish thoughts about ecology, and it causes trees to be cut down. He says, so here we are with the conundrum. We recognize that personal change is right in the heart of this thing. And what I find so great about Leopold is the gesture he makes next. He says, we can go and seek to live in the wilderness, in friends, if there is any left, and try to live on locusts and honey. Or we can do what I am proposing to do, what Leopold himself is proposing to do. And I find this eminently more humble in a way. He says, we can surreptitiously set up within the economic juggernaut that we currently have in place certain new cogs and wheels that will slow the process. We might be able to achieve small refuges, but it's an eminently humble kind of understanding of ecology that I find that, of that practice. If he's serious about this, he recognizes the cost of personal change. That's going to be part of it, but there is going to have to be a serious economic component to this. So I couldn't help it. She invoked Leopold. And so with that, that's one example that I think of. And it relates to the distinction that I'd like to talk about in Aquinas. The distinction that I propose to sort of focus my remarks on is the distinction between optus exercitus and optus signatus. It's the way I learned this, it's the bias, it's the lens through which I began to learn and read Aquinas. when I was a grad student at Boston College. And the teaching as I received it was this. It's the distinction between saying things about grammar or saying them grammatically. Saying things about humility or saying them humbly. And I began to really, that started to make it very difficult for me because I couldn't understand at the level of the signatio, at the level of the word, I could not understand Aquinas' account of humility. And one of my professors suggested that it's because I didn't know how to read humbly. That's probably true. But I wanted to figure out if there wasn't a way of inquiring humbly. You know, is that a possibility? So, that's kind of the background for my remarks. I'm very grateful for this paper, although I think the point at which I precisely disagree is on his page 7 and his claim that humility comes into its own against the horizon of the sacred. To me, that's what was most shocking to find in Aquinas, is that he prescinds from treating it theologically. It is not a cardinal virtue. It is treated as a subset of temperance, and it's the manner in which it's treated that is absolutely non-theological, in a sense. I agree, he has these remarks that you're talking about. So I'll make some arguments that way, and the way that I'll do it is to point to three simple ordering principles by which Aquinas would judge the ranking of a virtue in the hierarchy of virtues. So Joseph Pieper makes this great remark, you know, that sometimes modern and postmodern sensibilities sneer at the medieval who sits there and tries to figure out the great hierarchy of virtues. Pieper says, you know, without sneering, let's try to look at this. What's behind the process of trying to find a hierarchy? The first principle that Aquinas will use to determine the placement of a virtue in the hierarchy is, of course, as you say, the virtue should be prioritized with an eye toward their ability to contribute to reason. And I'll read a little bit now. The virtues are prioritized with an eye toward their ability to participate in reason, because reason is the highest capacity of the human soul. Aquinas asserts that, quote, among the moral virtues, one is better to the other to the extent that it approaches reason, end quote. His attempt to discern the hierarchy among the virtues, in his attempt, Aquinas asks a simple question. How do the particular virtues relate to reason? His consideration of this question as it relates to the virtues leads him to conclude that there are indeed four cardinal virtues. Aquinas notes that for some, the cardinal virtues are not diverse and distinct from one another. But Aquinas seems to disagree. For him, the cardinal virtues are diverse, distinct, and can be hierarchically ranked. Quote, since a cause is always more powerful than effect, and that the cause and root of the human good is reason, prudence surpasses in goodness the other moral virtues which perfect the appetitive power insofar as it participates in reason. By distinguishing the hinge virtues as they relate to reason, Thomas discovers that either a virtue is an act of reason itself, rationally essentially, as in the case of prudence, or it is an act of reason commanding something else, rational by participation, commanding something other ad alterum. It's reason directed ad alterum. And they are the only ones that can properly be called moral acts. Among those moral acts which are directed ad alterum, there is still a further critical distinction. Some acts are directed toward operations, and others are directed toward passions. Operations involve the use of the will, but the will is an appetite. It's the rational appetite. Therefore, justice, which is the virtue associated with acts related to operations, is next ranked after prudence in importance. But among the properly moral virtues, it is ranked highest. The passions, which are least rational powers associated with the human soul, further subdivide into irascible and concupiscible. Hence, in those matters which engage the concupiscible and the irascible powers, according as they are moved by reason, there must be some habit for effecting good action, not only in reason, but also in the irascible and concupiscible powers themselves. The virtue in the irascible and concupiscible powers is nothing else but a habitual conformity of these powers to reason, to the extent that they are rational by participation. As obedient to reason, they are then proper to the human. And in this way, they can be the subject of human virtue. The irascible are those passions which seek to overcome whatever deters one access to the suitable or resist whatever promotes the harmful.
fortitude is the hinge virtue related to the irascible urges or emotions in the human soul. The concupiscible are those passions which attempt to seek the pleasurable and flee the harmful. Temperance is the hinge virtue related to the concupiscible passions, which are by definition least susceptible of all the human capacities to participation in reason. One might say that temperance is the way in which the concupiscible appetites participate in reason, but the concupiscible appetites of themselves and in their objects are the most removed from reason. So the virtues of these appetites will be furthest away from reason, and so the least important of the virtues if you take the first ordering principle seriously. So it's just very pedestrian, but this is the first way I understood how is Aquinas talking. Well, he's speaking with a very simple ordering principle. How do these things participate in reason? Well, the concupiscible powers are least participatory in reason, but still natural. So next ordering principle. The virtues can be prioritized with an eye toward their ability to contribute to the common good. Thomas confirms the exact same hierarchy among the moral virtues by measuring the virtues in their capacity to contribute to the common good. And here's a little extended quote from Aquinas. The philosopher declares, the good of the many is more of the godlike than the good of the individual. Wherefore, the more a virtue regards the good of the many, the better it is. You know, justice and fortitude regard the good of many more than temperance does, since justice regards the relations between one man and another. While fortitude regards the dangers of battle which are endured for the common weal, whereas temperance moderates only the desires and pleasures which affect the human self. Hence, it is evident that justice and fortitude are more excellent virtues than temperance, while prudence and the theological virtues are more excellent still. So, we can see that. It's kind of fun. Thomas has, by two methods of consideration, found temperance to rank last among the cardinal virtues and last among the properly moral virtues. Presumably, any virtues which fall under its jurisdiction will be subordinated not only to temperance itself, but to fortitude and its particular virtues, and finally to justice and its particular virtues as well. Okay, the next section of this is the remnants of my dissertation that I'm trying to turn into a manuscript, so it's in rough shape right now. But there's a treatment of temperance in itself, and then in its parts. Aquinas treats that in the second part of the second part, questions 141 through 170. I simply put that in there as a way to set up once again the advent of humility. In other words, the roadmap to humility. We're talking about the virtues, their ranking, their ordering. Then we start to focus in on temperance in itself and in its parts. The more you peruse, you come upon another virtue called modesty, which is subordinated to temperance. The virtue of modesty reveals itself as a unique particular virtue subordinated to temperance. Thomas finds sufficient reason to consider it in itself and in its parts, thus indicating that this virtue, which in relations to temperance is subordinate, is also considered a general virtue in relation to those particular virtues which will fall within its purview later. Thomas clearly states his motive for recognizing the distinction. Quote, temperance brings moderation into those matters where it is hardest to preserve reasonable poise, namely, our lust for carnal pleasure. Now, wherever there's a special virtue for a matter at its maximum, there should be an associated virtue where the matter is more middling. And since human conduct needs to be ruled by virtue with regard to every interest, hence the need of some virtue tempering our feelings, where moderation is not as difficult as in matters of food and sex. This virtue is called modesty. Modesty can, according to Aquinas, in itself, apply to matters of human loving, the concern of moral virtue, to matters of mere cognition, the concern of intellectual virtue, and to matters of emotional powers, both irascible and concupiscible, and again, these matters with which moral virtue is generally concerned. But these matters fall specifically under the purview of fortitude and temperance. So modesty, here it comes, humility is going to suddenly pop out under twice, you know, it's under temperance, the last of the virtues,
it's going to appear under still another subordinated virtue, modesty, as one of the parts of modesty, which is itself a part of temperance, which is itself, by the two first criteria, most removed, you know, the least exalted of the virtues. Modesty, in its parts, relates to four distinct desires which do not relate to food or sex, but which still have to do with the concupiscible desires which are more middling, and which then divide into four related virtues. That quote points. First, humility tempers the desire for self-excellence, the desire to be esteemed, honored, or famous. Second, studiousness is the opposite of curiosity and tempers the desire to be a know-it-all. Third, decorum in our bodily actions, playful and serious. In both cases, it ensures that they are fitting, convenient, fitting and decent. Fourth, good style in outward show, namely our dress and the like. So there's the take that I felt like when I was coming at first as a young grad student, I had all these Augustinian appreciations of Aquinas, and I really fully expected humility to be treated in the way that Augustine seems to treat humility. There's that great quote in the Confessions that Augustine says, humility? Oh yeah, that's the foundation of charity. I think Aquinas would recognize that's a, talk about rhetorical, I mean, that's an excessive statement. You want to really carefully modify that in a serious theological framework. So I'll continue with a brief reading. Humility is not only a subset of the virtue which participates least in reason and contributes least to the common good, but it has even been subordinated to yet another more middling virtue, namely modesty. Even more surprising still is that humility appears in the neighborhood of virtues that we might take to be concerned with fashion and manners. Is humility then as trifling and lowly as these appear to be? And this is where I say, I think Augustine would certainly be shocked to find humility so highly esteemed by himself and by so many other great voices in the tradition, placed in the areas which contribute least to reason, so little to common good, and amid such other trifling virtues as those appear to be, if they are trifling indeed. Thomas is well aware of the incongruity. In fact, he directly addresses a question that could have been raised by a faithful Augustinian. Is humility then rightly placed beneath temperance and modesty? And this is where your statement gave me so much trouble, and that's why I had to figure out what ordering principle, if he's going to use right reason and common good, hasn't he exhausted his resources? No, it's Aquinas, so he's going to find some great, obscure ordering principle, which he does. Thomas will answer that often frustrating style of Dominicans, of seldom affirming outright, never disagreeing outright, but rather coming to an understanding based on a plethora of distinctions. Thomas addresses the Augustinian concern through a wonderfully inventive switch of ordering principles. Thomas turns away from the consideration of how a particular disposition may help us to participate in reason or how it might help us to contribute to the common good. In both of those schemas, temperance, modesty, and humility have been proven to be cataloged among the lowliest of the low. Thomas answers the Augustinian in this way, quote, I answer that the good of human virtue pertains to the order of reason, which order is considered chiefly in reference to the end. Wherefore, the theological virtues are the greatest, because they have the last end for their object. Secondarily, however, it is considered in reference to the ordering of the means to the end. That's that new, where is this coming from? This ordinance, he says, as to its essence, is in the reason itself from which it issues, but by participation, it is in the appetite ordered by the reason. And this ordinance is the effect of justice, especially legal justice. Now humility makes a man a good subject to ordinance of all kinds and in all matters, while every other virtue has this effect in some special matter. Therefore, after the theologicals, after the intellectual virtues, which regard the reason itself, and after justice, especially legal justice, then humility stands before all the others. So in the drama that was going on in my research mind, I was thinking, Augustine is really not going to be satisfied with this. It seems too natural a treatment. It, you know, for me, that was the struggle I had. And maybe there's one.
more piece to say, but I want to have time for. And then in the work, I go ahead and try to contrast and nuance some of Aristotle. There is a common opinion that Aristotle would simply remark that humility is a vice. At least in the research I was able to do, I'm not entirely persuaded that that's true. Even just trying to stay within a direct study of Aristotle himself, he seems to have some interesting concessions that could allow for, but you're certainly right, he's not aware of modifying this in terms of theological approaches. But the last thing I'd like to share with you then is something that Aquinas does that I find utterly beautiful and so crazy and compelling in his account of not only that he finds a way to switch up the ordering principles, but then he does what I think is, I would cautiously call something like a psychological analogy. He considers the condition, what are the conditions under which humility and magnanimity, as you nicely showed, are both necessary? Well, he says there's a human soul. Imagine the soul. It's confronted with not just a bonum, not just with a good, but rather with a bonum arduum. Joseph Pieper calls it a steep good, a good that at once the soul is attracted because of the bonum character, but simultaneously there's a motu, so that's the motu spei. The soul undergoes a motion of hope, suffers the advent of a motion of hope, because this is bonum, this is achievable by me. The soul at the exact same time appreciates the arduum, and therefore, Aquinas says, undergoes a second motion. And I always imagine them simultaneously. He doesn't say that, but I think the soul is beset by two opposed motions. A motion, motus spei, a motion of hope, because that thing is good, and a motus desperationis, a motion of despair, because that thing is really difficult. This is an appropriate thing to study when you're trying to write a dissertation, but, you know, it's like, I think I can do this. I can't do this. I know I can't do this. Okay, so it's a performative exercise. But then that's when Aquinas deploys something that I think would dissatisfy both Aristotle and Augustine. And in this treatment, I find his most compelling practice, the actus exercitus, to be the way that he, it's not what he says about humility anymore that interests me, it's how he treats this thing that becomes so captivating. And so, you know, here's the soul beset by two motions. Well, of course then, you need humility to caution the overweening pride that assumes that just, one of my undergrads told me, she took a class she really liked from a medievalist at our school, and she's 20, you know, she says, I'm a medievalist. I'm thinking, holy smokes, you like that class you had with a guy who wishes he was a medievalist, you know. So there's, you know, she's achieved the goal without any work. And so she needs some humility, you know. And the other person, you know, the person who's in despair, you know, he's going to say this is now we have a need for some magnanimity. That could be that you could have a sense of proper pride in your achievements. I wonder how Augustine would, you know, this is where for me the dialogue got interesting. Maybe that's where I'll leave off for dialogue and continue conversation with either of us. Thanks.
You made about the issue of humility in Aristotle. I might be able to help you there. If you're thinking humility, modesty, the Greek term eidos, Aristotle does say that it's necessary to cultivate virtue, but once one becomes virtuous, it's basically dumped because you no longer need to rely on it because he understands it as more a feeling or an emotion rather than a state of character. And he does talk about this in the Nicomachean Ethics, that the youth need a sense of modesty. Without this sense of modesty, it will be very, very difficult to interest them in virtue, but they have to eventually give up modesty as they recognize they no longer need a feeling to motivate them anymore. And I can, in fact, give you the exact sections where he says this. I don't have them off the top of my head.
Okay, good. I should say that the main textual part where I focused was, because I felt like June was right, that there's kind of this locus of attention in the great soul man, the megalos, the great soul person. You know, I thought that might be a place to see, even if in there, is there any I'd love to see it. Sorry. Thanks.
I wonder if that corresponds in Aquinas to verecundia, which is kind of it's a sense of shame, and it's not something that a virtuous person really needs, because they're never going to do anything which is going to shame them, but it's something people need in order to get to that state of virtue, because it will prevent them from doing the evil things that will lead them to vice. So it's especially needed in youth, and I think maybe that, but it's helpful because I wasn't aware that Aristotle had been talking about it, but I know Aquinas better than Aristotle, so it's helpful for me to see where one of the roots might have been. I think probably Ambrose talked about modesty in that kind of way as well.
Sort of put a Protestant spin on your Arduum, and think about Jonathan Edwards, who says that the mountain is the type of our spiritual life because we are inclined to climb it by our spiritual need to get up there, but we must overcome the reluctance of the flesh in order to do it.
I mean, I'll trade a story with you that a Catholic would for a Protestant one. Aquinas in his incipit lecture, when he comes to the University of Paris and now he gets to sit in front of all the magisters and do his thing, he has a very strange use of humility in that business, his opening lecture. He says, humility modifies the magister who's at the top of the mountain. And the job of the humble magister is to reflect light into the valley so the valley fructifies. Again, it's weird. It's not a subjugation humility that he's teaching. You know, it's a very diverse deployment, even within the Aquinas that I was able to find. You know, there's tons of references. I once probably have looked at them all. But I think that one is fantastic about the height of the work that we face, the arduousness. But the magister has the temptation to mistake. This is where he's still really Augustinian. Mistake himself for the source of light. That would be a real mistake. Pride, the kind of investment. Yeah.
I think in humility, again, primarily is true. I still get back to that. But,
Aquinas says that it rests not in estimation, but in passions.
Right. But let me give you an example. I had several students over the years. And I've had some very brilliant students, and some of them went nowhere because of their pride. They couldn't learn because they thought they knew it all. In other words, in order to learn, you have to be able to receive. You have to be open to the truth. If you think you have all the truth, you're not open. And I think that's not only true in learning, but it's true in many areas. To really become great, you have to be humble in order to be receptive. You have to know who you are.
I mean, I think I agree with you. Maybe one way to put this, that's what started to captivate me with the help of my dissertation director, was to look, what are the implications of this naturalistic treatment of humility for, say, Aquinas' epistemology? What does that mean about how he thinks about knowing and the practice of inquiry? And there's a lot of meaning
in that. You know, great principle, like what is received is received according to the manner of the receiver.
Yes.
And the student who's not capable of receiving, who doesn't listen because he already knows the answers. And I've had students come into class And I would lecture on something and give them a quiz, and they'll say the exact opposite because that's what they thought I was should say, not what I was really saying. They weren't listening. They already thought they had been doing.
Yes. I don't know, my memory might be not serving me well here, and I'll ask you, or maybe James can help out too, but is it true that Aristotle's definition of pride in the Nicomachean Ethics and Aquinas' definition of humility are formally the same? I mean, formally, not with content, but that I thought I remembered or came to the... or saw that both of them were an accurate self-appraisal of oneself and what is properly due one. And of course, given different possibilities with regard to what's open to the human being, that's why one's going to look more like pride than one's going to look like humility. I don't know if I'm remembering correctly on that point or not. But
this is great. If I could just move on a second, I just told Nick last night, I don't know that I've ever given a humility presentation or talk that this didn't come up. It has to be centered. I mean, self-assessment. Usually people use the phrase, it was Socrates humble. You know, that's a fun paper if you ever want to, you know, start a brain war. what would you say to that? This, I love this question.
Well, in a way it connects with the truth question that you went in a different direction than I supposed. It seems to me that one can't be humble unless one has the truth about who one is in relationship to what is. And so there's an epistemic or a cognitive substrate. Humility, Thomas insists, is a matter of the will. And I think that's a critical fact. And I think among the many ways in which Aquinas so opens Aristotle is that with grace our will can be strengthened. And what might be a hopeless puzzle, a weakness of the will, is really to be embraced as an indication that perhaps you need to look elsewhere beyond your own will. And I think in terms of perhaps the difference that you present, I don't really think there is a difference in terms of the sacredness of arising. One of the perplexing things in contemporary liberal thought, among other places, but especially there, is something like, to paraphrase it, we know damn well we're not equal. Why should we treat other people as equal? Well, because there are a lot of them, and they might sneak up on us. So we better treat them as equal. The fact of the matter is, we are equal, but we'll come to recognize that only if we recognize that which is of God in every person. And again and again and again, John Paul II said, you lose track of the reality of God and you've lost track of the dignity of man. And I think that is an exact connection.
Yeah,
that
raises the precise thing. I'm thinking, in Heidegger, he talks about how in our everyday world, we are constantly comparing ourselves to each other. Am I as a keeping up or falling behind? Kierkegaard, on the other hand, talks about standing alone before God in our guilt. Then you really know who you are. Then you become a real individual. Not when you look at, well, how do I compare everybody else to? Am I smarter than them or not? If I stand before God, I really know who I am. I think that's really the idea of humility.
Just going back to comment, I was just thinking that it's interesting that the two sayings over the public oracle were nothing excess and no less. That kind of gets brought up when Hermione's talking about what is being contemporary. So it's a combination of self-knowledge to even know yourself as at the end of the time. But it isn't, you know, it isn't the idea of sort of the world like this. So I just wondered how humility, if there's any connection, but floated any way out of.
I mean, from if I could, that was the thing made probably, if I, you know, I don't know what,
dissertation research is worth, but I remember feeling a great burden to make the judgment that Aquinas, it strikes me that even Nietzsche still suffers in his understanding of humility from a binary opposition between humility and pride. And that makes sense, given the context that he seems to have been trying to resuscitate this heroic rising of where exactly that binary opposition is what we're banking on. And so a lot of the early horrid work of this was going through Aeschylus and finding out what did that instance of the use of humility mean. And I did find a kind of unique, univocal assessment in the early Greeks that's kind of affirming this binary opposition. Oceanus tries to, there's a lot of fun, a lot of eating and drinking in that, but I don't think Aquinas, it doesn't seem to me that he suffers from that binary opposition in the way that most people assessing humility do. That if pride, then not humble, if humble, then not proud. I don't think that works in Aquinas. I think it works in a lot of people's ethics, but I just am not convinced that it does function there in Aquinas, but could be wrong.
This might be going in a different way with your point, but it's one thing to know yourself, all for it, hoping to do so someday. However, you can know yourself and still not act on that knowledge. So we have the evolving Plato coming to wonder what a virtue can be taught. And a very interesting link here is with Carl Newman. I'm going to start school, right? I'm going to start a school in Ireland. Well, do it. I'm going to start a school in Ireland. So are we going to teach virtue? And he says, well, the problem of teaching virtue is you might just as well try to teach virtue as to hold a ship in port by a thread or to quarry granite with a razor.
Yeah.
He says you can't do it. The only thing you can do is to have a community within the school. Which takes us back to the emphasis on community. We have a community within the school. And there in that community within the school, we could do that. But of course, now we have same-sex dorms, so it doesn't quite work out there.
I'm a little bit curious about what you think about the possibility of Aquinas' subordination of humility to moderation, or like the scheme, because I cannot help but think he's dead wrong on this. Do you think this is at all plausible? Because
I think it does agree with you.
In species, humility seems to be more like a cognitive virtue or intellectual virtue, right? It has to do with our ability, how we think of ourselves and so on.
Yeah, this is his question. Isn't this formally the same? I mean, there's a formal similarity.
No, but I mean, but moderation seems, more like a moral virtue. I mean, so the subordination doesn't seem to work at all. So Aquinas is all good and fine, but wrong. I mean,
I would never say that. that's what my Dominican background would say. Let's make a bunch of distinctions here all afternoon if you want, and we'll see what he actually was saying. You know, this is how this whole thing got started. It was an offhand comment actually from a Dominican, from a Jesuit, who said to me, You're reading Aquinas through like book 19 of the City of God lens, Augustinian lens. I think you'll be shocked when you come to understand the structures that Aquinas is working with. And it's a puzzle. I mean, I think it's a problem. I don't know that I buy Aquinas' account, but I think it's inventive and exciting. And of all the pre-modern accounts, as far as I could tell, it's the only one that doesn't suffer from an assumption of the binary opposition of humility and pride. And even the steps go back, they're the humility and pride. It's all they're hidden. And Aquinas kind of short circuits that and says, no, both are virtues. Take that, Well, how does he do this? What are the grounds for this? Before I'm even asking whether he's right, what is he saying?
But intuitively speaking, to have humility of a species, a subclass of moderation,
yes.
Does that strike you as being an possibly right?
Yes, if you accept what he, and this is okay. The remark I made to him, that it's primarily of Aquinas. I can quote you, it's not in the estimative. It is not primarily, and that's where this question of self-knowledge comes. Well, I thought humility was about knowing myself.
So knowing is the operative word you just smuggled in there. He says that it really is more a matter of feelings. I don't know what to make of Aquinas' analogy, but it's his argument. I know that much.
We do need to wrap up this session and continue the intellectual nourishment, but accompany it with physical nourishment and a basement. Lunch is being served. Something's not all right.